on the suit button today, and I was able to get the belt into the second notch. So that's a very good sign. As you might have guessed, today we're going to continue to study the topic of friendship with Jesus Christ, as he promised us in John 15 and verse 14. He says, "You are my friends if you do whatever I command you. No longer do I call you servants, for a servant doesn't know what his master is doing, but I've called you friends. For all things that I've heard from my Father, I've made known to you." So the scripture that we're going to talk about today is Matthew 5, verse 42. Matthew 5, verse 42. I'm sure this is something that makes every one of us want to go out and comply with this scripture right away. We want to find a way to do this, every one of us. It's the first thing on our minds. It's going to be a burning issue in our hearts all week, because Christ says, "Give to him who asks you, and from him who wants to borrow from you, don't turn away." So I'm looking at a group of people who have given, because of the commandment, have given up, have sacrificed in accordance with God's commandments, 10%, 20%, 30% of their salaries, plus offerings on the holy days. And so Jesus says to us, to this group of people, "Give to him who asks of you, and from him who wants to borrow of you, don't turn away." So Jesus wants us to be a generous people. He wants us to have compassion for others. We should be able to be touched and motivated to help by the genuine needs of others. He wants us to be benevolent. Let's turn over to James. This is the attitude that Jesus wants us to have. I just turned this so it wouldn't reflect on my iPad in that way that is really distressing. Maybe I turned it the wrong way. There we go. James chapter 2, verse 14 to 18. And from the New King James Version, James says, "What does it profit, my brethren, if someone says he has faith but doesn't have works? Can faith save him? Now," he says, for instance, "if a brother or sister is naked," that just means inappropriately or inadequately clothed, "is naked and destitute of daily food, and one of you says to him or her, 'Depart in peace, be warmed and filled,' but you don't give him the things that are needed for the body, what does it profit? Thus also faith by itself, if it does not have works, is dead. But someone will say to you, 'You have faith and I have works. Show me your faith without your works, and I will show you my faith by my works.'" So our works are the evidence of the faith that we have and the faith that by which we live. And James points out that it's a Christian's duty to provide for the needy fellow Christian. And let's look at Galatians 6, because we get a little more guidance in this area, the area of giving. As I said, Jesus wants his people to be generous. And in Galatians 6 and verse 9, it says, "Let's not grow weary in while doing good." Sorry, I'm lapsing back into the King James. This is New King James, which says, "Let's not be weary while doing good. For in due season," it says, "we shall reap if we don't lose heart. Therefore," number one, "as we have opportunity, let us do good to all, but especially to those who are of the household of faith." So we get a little guidance in there in how our generosity ought to be meted out. Preference is supposed to be given to the household of faith. So are we required to give to anyone who asks us? Well, I believe we could quickly deplete all our resources in that way. In the first century, I don't think you could be, in a single week, you couldn't be requested to give money by a dozen, two dozen, three dozen different people or organizations. But in this present day, that's quite possible. There are a lot of organizations. I don't know about you, but in our household, we receive 5, 10, 15, 20, as many as 20 telemarketing calls in a week. Most of them organizations asking us to donate money. Now, many of these organizations have vast resources and might not be considered needy because they asked and because of the word of Jesus Christ. Are we obligated to give money to anybody that calls us on the telephone? I don't think that Jesus Christ or any of the apostles in the first century could have been accosted by, requested to donate money by 2 dozen, 3 dozen different people. But in this present day, with our enhanced communication, our enhanced ability to reach out and touch someone, that's quite possible. So we get a lot of telephone calls, and somehow we fell off the do not call list. Has anyone ever put his name on the do not call list? Did it work?
No.
Okay. So a lot of these organizations, you couldn't really consider them needy, and yet they continue to solicit. I think that I'm going to write down a little script, and the next time someone calls me requesting money, I might say something like, "I'm glad you called. This is Hugh Buchanan, and I'm a representative of the White-Haired League of Washington County, Maryland, and we're soliciting donations to support our retired members." And, I don't know how far you get with that, because these people are just experts at talking over you and not allowing themselves to be interrupted. I keep getting phone calls from the Fraternal Order of the State Police. Now, this is a cause that's near and dear to my heart. I love the state police in Maryland. Frankly, I don't think there's a more worthless law enforcement agency on the face of the earth. And they continually call me for money. So I listened to the guy start his spiel, and I couldn't get a word in edgewise, so I just laid the phone down and went and watched TV for a while. When I came back, he was gone, and I consider this to be a good way to deal with the problem. Well, who's encountered panhandlers on the street? Panhandlers. I drive to Baltimore once a month. I go to Johns Hopkins Hospital. It's right in the heart of Baltimore. And in good weather, not in bad weather, not when it's raining, not when there's 3 inches of snow on the ground, but in good weather, when you come to a stop, there are people that just appear, ragamuffins, people wearing ragged clothing and holding signs and walking around with spackle buckets for you to put money in. You think, does he really collect enough money in a day to need a spackle bucket? But and am I obligated, because some person claiming to be homeless and needy has walked up to my car, by the words of Jesus Christ, am I obligated to roll down the window and give him money? When I'm in the heart of a big city, I don't even want to roll down the car window. In some large cities, there is someone panhandling money on every block. Many years ago, about 9 or 10 years ago, my company sent me on a business trip to Charleston, South Carolina. And there was another guy with me, a guy that worked for me. His name was Scott. And so we're in Charleston. Charleston is a prosperous city. You go walk down the main drag in Charleston, there are many, many 10, 20, 30-story bank buildings. And it's a really good location if you're a panhandler, if you're a bum, because there are a number of banks on in this town. It's the center of banking in the South, maybe. And there are a lot of people walking up and down the street in three-piece suits, and they have a lot of money. So if you want to beg for money, that's, they ask Willie Sutton, why do you rob banks? He says, because that's where the money is. So if you're panhandling, you want to go to someplace like Charleston, South Carolina, because that's where the money is. So I went to this 3-day seminar in Charleston, South Carolina, and of course, my company is paying for my food and my lodging, but I went to the bank and said, "Do you want quick cash?" And I said, "Yes." And so quick cash is 320s. So I took 320s with me to Charleston, South Carolina. And there was a 7-Eleven across the street from the hotel where we were staying. And so I went over to the 7-Eleven to get a soda or a bottle of water or something. And as I came out of the 7-Eleven, two things happened. Number one, the guy that I was traveling with walked out of the hotel toward me and saw what happened. And this guy came up to me and he said, "I haven't had anything to eat all day. Can you give me some money so I can get something to eat here at 7-Eleven?" Well, I didn't have any change. All I had was the 320s. Thinking back on it, I don't know why. I must have gone to 7-Eleven and not bought anything because I went to town with 320s and nothing else. So all I had was, I felt sorry for the guy, and he was asking me. And Jesus said, "Give to everybody that asks of you." So I said, "Well, that's terrible if the guy hasn't eaten all day." It makes me wonder if I feel that badly about people who haven't eaten all day, what I should do on the Day of Atonement when I come here. But whatever. I gave the guy a 20. So I just turned my back and walked away from him. And later in the hotel, Scott, the guy I was traveling with, said, "I saw you gave that guy 20 bucks outside 7-Eleven. I said, "Yeah, I did." He says, "He and his buddy went into 7-Eleven and spent it all on beer. They bought as much beer as they could with your 20 bucks." So I don't know how much beer you can buy for 20 bucks. Maybe it was a couple cases of cans. It makes you wonder, if you help a guy panhandling on the street, are you really helping him, or are you just supporting some kind of behavior that you wouldn't condone? Are you supporting alcoholism or a drug habit? I think when we went up, this was out on the outskirts of town near the hotel. Later, we walked into town and we walked up the main street, parked the car, walked up the main street looking for a restaurant. And we only walked 100 yards or so, but I was panhandled two more times before we got to the restaurant. And I thought, I have never seen so many bums looking for a handout as I have in this city. So it's a prosperous city. And panhandlers aren't dumb. I've done a little research on the web. And in Las Vegas, you find a lot of panhandlers. Why? Because there's a lot of money in Las Vegas, right? And probably on Fifth Avenue in New York City and other places like that, you find a lot of panhandlers. That's where the money is. And I saw one video about some poor woman that was begging for money. She was bent over at the waist like this. And she had a set of those crutches, that metal crutches that have braces that grasp you around the arms. And she's walking over almost like an animal with her head bowed down toward the ground, walking on crutches in this fashion. And a camera crew filmed her discreetly so she didn't know what was happening. I guess they were using a telephoto lens. And they photographed this lady all day hobbling around very painfully, almost on her, you know, with her torso parallel to the ground, begging people for money. And they continued to follow her from a discreet distance when she was finished the day. And she walked several blocks away from where she had been begging and got to a really nice late model SUV, stood up, put the crutches in the car, got in the car, changed her clothes, and drove home. So that's her occupation. You can't say that everybody that panhandles money or is begging money is a bum. And Jesus told us to give to everyone who asks of you. And Jesus wants us to have a generous and a giving spirit. I don't think that we should give money to every bum that asks us on the street. And every organization that calls and wants money, we made a partial list. Wounded Warriors, these are the people that have called us. Breast cancer, leukemia, disabled veterans, political campaigns. Somebody called me yesterday, wanted me to donate money to Donald Trump. Me donating money to Donald Trump, Donald Trump has, how many billions of dollars does he have? and somebody wants me to donate money to him, give me a break. And some scam artists prey on the elderly. My dad was 83 when he died. And we found some small payments that had been made in his checkbook to somebody we didn't recognize, maybe $5, $10. And after he died, I was in his house. We were cleaning up. We were, you know, how it is. You're trying to find things to sell on a yard sale and trying to throw things away. And somebody called. And the guy said, "Hi, is this Mr. Buchanan?" And it was. I, you know, still am Mr. Buchanan. So I said, "Yes." So he said, "Well, how are you doing?" And he made some small talk. And then he asked me if he could have some more money, if I would send him some more money. And I said, "No, I don't think so." And I was trying to, I thought, how can I find this guy? How can I get him to come and meet me? But I was afraid I might rip his face off because obviously he had been preying on my father in his advanced years. But there are scam artists who call the elderly and prey on the elderly. Whose ranks I now have joined, the elderly. So don't any of you call me for money this week. So I think when Jesus said, "Give to whomever who asks you," I think that he was, in those days, if someone was a beggar, there were several occasions of people who had been crippled from birth and blind from birth, and they were begging, and Jesus and the disciples saw these guys every day, and they knew they were beggars, and they knew they had a legitimate disabilities. I think Jesus, when he says, "Give to everyone who asks you," he wants us to be generous with people whom we know. He wants us to be generous with the brethren, if the brethren have any needs. People we recognize, people whose need we understand and recognize and can verify. We're exposed to hundreds of times more people in our lives today than any man or woman in the first century would have been. So we can look at the example of the Good Samaritan. Here's a man who found somebody who was beaten and left for dead, and he saw the need, and he knew the need was real, and he opened his heart, and he fulfilled the man's need. And you remember that he took him to an inn, he bound his wounds, he washed them with wine, and he bound up the guy's wounds. He got him a room in the hotel, he got him food, he gave money to have him looked after, and he said, "When I come back here, if there's anything else on this account, I'll pay for it." So he was able to be touched by someone else's need, and he was generous in his support, and he had a heart of compassion when he recognized someone who was truly suffering and truly in need. So this is the kind of situation where we must be generous and we must be giving in order to comply with Jesus' commandment to us. And we have to be careful that we're not enabling people who have bad habits and who are too lazy to work. I guess it was about 1991 or 92, I was on my way home for lunch. I lived close enough to work that I came home for lunch every day. That was great. And I was driving by a shopping mall, and I saw a guy standing in front of the shopping mall, and he had a big sign that said, "We'll work for food." And I had talked about this to my friend at work. He says, "Well, if he had looked right across the street, he would have seen that McDonald's was hiring and Taco Bell was hiring. They needed people. This guy was well enough to stand out on the street corner and hold up a sign. Why can't he go to work for himself?" So he appeared to be young and able-bodied. I thought I'd like to test this out, see if he really is that needy. I went into the supermarket there in the mall where he was standing, and I bought him a sack of potatoes and a couple cans of beans. So as I came out the mall, I just handed him the bag. I wasn't about to give him any money, but I did give him something. How desperate does a man have to be driven to begging? Would anyone in this room stand on a corner and beg? There are two dozen things that I would do before I would be reduced to the point where I would humiliate myself, where I would be willing to stand out on a street corner and beg. The papers are full of jobs for skilled people. You hear the politicians talking about how we're going to create jobs. They don't have to create jobs. The government doesn't have to do that. There's plenty of jobs. But you've got to have skills, and you've got to have experience. And so what people who are homeless, if they're truly homeless and they truly can't get a job, what they really need is not food. They need skills and experience. Well, whether you decide to help the bum on the street, this is something you'll need to struggle with and come to some decision about what you're going to do. Because I was talking with this over with Bonnie for several weeks now. I've been thinking about this. And Bonnie says, well, maybe the guy doesn't deserve anything. Maybe he doesn't need anything. But God isn't judging his attitude. He's judging our attitude. All right? So that's one of the things to consider when you decide whether or not you're going to give money to everybody who asks. You can always find an excuse for not giving somebody money. I remember every year the companies that I worked for would have a campaign where they encouraged, more than encouraged, almost coerced the employees to give to the United Way and to make a pledge to give to the United Way. And I guess I did this for a couple of years, and then sometime in the 90s, the United Way announced that they weren't going to support the Boy Scouts anymore because the Boy Scouts, in their view, discriminated against certain groups of people. So at that point, I stopped donating to the United Way, and I never did again. And I could justify that because of their attitude toward the Boy Scouts. So we can always find a good reason why we shouldn't give to some organization. And remember that maybe the organization or the individual doesn't need it. And remember also that God is not judging them. God's judging us. He's looking at our attitude. And God looks on the heart. And God is requiring us to be generous. So each of us will have to establish a policy about charitable giving. God's looking at our hearts to see if we are giving and generous. We're the ones who are being judged, not the beggars who may be frauds. God will deal with them later. What God is judging right now is our attitude. Now, there is a way to help the needy. I checked out three towns. I checked out Frederick, Maryland. I checked out Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. And I checked out York, Pennsylvania. If you Google York, Pennsylvania Food Bank, Harrisburg, Pennsylvania Soup Kitchen, you will find organizations that provide for the needs of the homeless and the hungry and the jobless. So I think that you could fulfill Christ's command by finding a food bank or finding a soup kitchen and making a donation to the soup kitchen or the food bank. Then you know that you're giving to some organization, you're providing for the needy in a way where your giving, your attitude of giving, won't be abused. You won't be supporting a drug habit or an alcohol habit, and you won't be taken advantage of. What really is obnoxious, and it's happened to me a couple times, as the incident that I told you about, where I gave the guy $20 and he and his buddy went back into 7-Eleven, bought a bunch of beer. It's really noxious to give to someone and be taken advantage of in this way. And it's happened to me a couple times. One time when I was a kid and I had an allowance of a dollar, some beggars came down our street begging for money, and I wanted to help them, and I gave them some money, and then they laughed at me. They had taken advantage of me, and they knew it, and they were laughing at me. It really hurts to try to help somebody and then be taken advantage of. So if you make a donation to a food bank on an annual basis, or you make a donation to a soup kitchen, I think you're complying with Jesus' command to be generous to those who are needy. So Jesus wants us to be generous. He wants us to support the needy. But there's a warning, because some people in Jesus' day, and perhaps some even today, were giving not to serve the needs of of the homeless or the hungry, but to serve their own needs. Now, I don't think that this is necessarily a fault or a flaw that would afflict anybody in this congregation or any other congregation for that matter, but it's a command of Jesus, and so I'd like to examine it. And it's in Matthew 6 and verse 1. Christ was making an example, in this case, of the Pharisees. Now, when he says in Matthew 6, 1, "Take heed that you don't do your charitable deeds before men," he's presuming that you will do charitable deeds. He's already covered that in the previous chapter. You will do charitable deeds. That's my command to you, Jesus says. But then he says, when you do them, don't do them before men to be seen by them. Otherwise, you have no reward from your Father in heaven. Therefore, when you do a charitable deed, don't sound a trumpet before you as the hypocrites do in the synagogues. And there are two things that Jesus was merciful and gentle with sinners, but there are two things. There are two things that really grated on him. And we'll talk about both of them. First is hypocrisy. He says, so if you want to be the friend of Jesus Christ, we can't be hypocrites. And I'm not saying this to you because I think we are, just because it's a command of Christ and we have to go over it. He says, don't be like the hypocrites do in the synagogues and in the streets, that they may have glory from men. Assuredly, I say to you, they have their reward. But when you do a charitable deed, don't let your left hand know what your right hand is doing. Again, a bit of hyperbole on the part of Jesus Christ. Like pluck out your right eye or cut off your right hand. He says now, don't let your left hand know what your right hand is doing. Charitable giving is to be a secret between you and God alone. That your charitable deed may be in secret. And your Father, who sees in secret, will himself reward you openly. So, not that I think any of you might be a hypocrite, but there is an admonition from Jesus to be beware of hypocrisy when we make charitable gifts. We can't be doing it to receive the approbation and respect of men, because, as Jesus says, that's your reward, that's all you get. Yet, it seems that there is a reward for the generous person. A couple years ago, I gave a sermon about the Christian wage. And it's as if Christians are on a piecework schedule. Years ago, for a short time, I was working in construction. And sometimes we would get paid on an hourly basis, and sometimes we get paid piecework. One of the things that was the most profitable was installing zero clearance fireplaces and chimneys. A couple men could earn in about 2 hours what we normally earned in a week. And we were working on piecework. We got paid in accordance with what we produced. So there is a reward for Christians. Let's look at just as one example. This example doesn't talk about charitable giving. It talks about Christians' work. 1 Corinthians chapter 3 and verse 6. Paul's talking about what he had done. He said, "I planted, Apollos watered, but God gave the increase. So then neither he who plants is anything nor he who waters, but God who gives the increase. Now he who plants and he who waters are one, and each one will receive his own reward according to his own labor." So reward, the word for reward is wage. And you get a wage in accordance with your labor. So in terms of the works that we do, charitable giving is one work, and there is a reward for that. Hypocrites have only the reward of fleeting admiration of people. But we are looking for the admiration, the fellowship, the friendship, the glory attributed to us by Jesus Christ. So we want to be sincere in this, not hypocrites. And Jesus goes on to discuss hypocrites at some length in several different scriptures. Let's look at Mark 12 and verse 38. Mark 12 and verse 38, Jesus said to them, Beware of the scribes who desire to go about in long robes, and they love greetings in the marketplace and the best seats in the synagogues, the best places at feasts, and yet they devour widows' houses and for pretense make long prayers. These will receive greater condemnation. Jesus did not like, could not abide the hypocritical approach to life, the hypocritical approach to religion of the scribes and Pharisees. It was all for show. They greeted each other in the marketplace so that everybody could hear them. Oh, there are a couple righteous men enjoying each other's fellowship. Matthew 23, Jesus truly levels the Pharisees for the things that they do, for their attitudes, and for their goals, which was the approbation, the glory of men. Matthew 23 and verse 1. Jesus spoke to the multitudes and to his disciples, saying, "The scribes and the Pharisees sit in Moses' seat. Therefore, whatever they tell you to observe, that observe and do. But don't do according to their works. Don't follow their example. For they say and they do not. For they bind heavy burdens, hard to bear, and lay them upon men's shoulders." Now, what he's saying when he says they sit in Moses' seat, you remember that Moses would judge Israel. Whoever had a case, whoever had a cause, would bring it to Moses, and Moses would give a judgment. And that's what he's talking about here. Christ is talking about the Pharisees rendering judgment in civil cases. So he said, whatever they tell you to do in these disputes, these civil cases, do, but don't follow their works, for they say and do not, for they bind heavy burdens, hard to bear, and lay them upon men's shoulders, but they themselves will not move them with one of their fingers. But all their works they do to be seen by men. So when we do charitable giving, it's not to be seen by anybody except God. They make their phylacteries broad and enlarge the borders of their garments. They love the best places at feast, the best seats in the synagogues, greetings in the marketplace, and to be called by men, Rabbi, Rabbi. But you, don't you be called Rabbi. And skipping down to verse 13, Jesus begins to condemn them. He says, "Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, you hypocrites, for you shut up the kingdom of heaven against men, for you neither go in yourselves, nor do you allow those who are entering to go in. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you devour widows' houses, and for a pretense make long prayers." Verse 25, "Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you cleanse the outside of the dish." In other words, you appear to be good, but on the inside you're full of extortion and self-indulgence. Extortion. You know, how might that work? How might they be full of extortion? Did you know that if you were expelled, the Pharisees were in charge of the synagogue. The Sadducees were in charge of the temple, but the Pharisees were in charge of the synagogue. Whatever they said in the synagogue went. Now, you remember about the man who was born blind and Jesus healed him, and the Pharisees yanked his parents in and they demanded that the parents tell him how this man who was born blind could now see. And they said, "Well, we don't know. All we know is he was born blind. And they said, he's of age, so he was blind for a long time. He's of age, he can speak for himself." And they were afraid they'd be cast out of the synagogue. Now, to be cast out of the synagogue was like becoming a non-person. Nobody could do business with you. Nobody could have any contact with you socially. It was like being, well, you were shunned. You couldn't do business. You couldn't buy. You couldn't sell. You couldn't have any contact with your old friends. So if the Pharisees had this kind of power, you can see the coercion they were exerting on this couple who had the man born blind who was their son. They were coercing them to find out what it was that caused this man to be blind. And was he really blind, or was this some put up thing? And so they coerced these people, and was it the son who was eventually put out of the synagogue? I forget. Somebody was put out. But the Pharisees had this power over the ordinary Jew that you could be put out of the synagogue, and for all intents and purposes, your business life and your social life would end. And I'm sure that they, being the kind of people who would devour widows' houses, do you think they didn't use that coercive power to get their way with the average man on the street? I'm sure they did. They're full of extortion and self-indulgence. Extortion. They extorted people using their economic and social power over them. He says, blind Pharisee, first cleanse inside the cup. Yeah, the cup looks pretty clean on the outside, but the crud on the inside would turn your stomach, is what Jesus is saying. First cleanse the inside of the cup and dish, that the outside of them may be clean also. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you're like whitewashed tombs, which indeed appear beautiful outwardly, but inside are full of dead men's bones and all uncleanness. Even so, you also outwardly appear righteous to men, but inside you are full of hypocrisy and lawlessness. And Jesus Christ despises hypocrisy, and he despises lawlessness. Iniquity, and in the King James Version, it's translated as iniquity, lawlessness. And Jesus says, depart from me, all you who work iniquity. So the aim here in all these sermons is to be the friend of Jesus Christ. And if we want to be his friend, we can't be hypocrites. We can't be lawless. So 8 times Jesus pronounced woe on the Pharisees for their hypocrisy. His complaint is that all they do is for show and pretense. The good works were a pretense. The fine robes that were supposed to be symbols of righteousness, these men weren't righteous. They were hypocrites. They were extortioners. Even their prayers were for pretense. Their true inward nature was corrupt. And Jesus calls them hypocrites. The Greek word means actors. Yeah, they were the priests, but they weren't really fulfilling the role. They were just like a bunch of guys that you had hired at Central Casting to go out into the streets and appear to be righteous men. He accuses them of being pretenders. They hold positions that proclaim that they're righteous. They wear garb that identifies them as righteous people. They sit in positions of stature and of authority in any gathering, yet they're only going through the motions. They're not truly righteous. They're pretending. It was an elaborate scam, an elaborate deception. Inwardly, they were unclean. Jesus characterizes them as whitewashed tombs. So in those days, an above-ground sepulcher would be whitewashed. It would be painted white so you could see it at night, because if a priest were to stumble going down the road and unknowingly touch a sepulcher, he'd be unclean. He wouldn't be able to perform his duties for some period of time. So the sepulchers were whitewashed so they'd be visible at night. So although the Pharisees appeared to be righteous, they were like these sepulchers, which were good and pure looking on the outside, but inside they were filled with uncleanness. They were the epitome of the unclean state that characterized the Pharisees. So to be Jesus' buddy, we can't be hypocrites. In Matthew 24 and verse 48 to 51, Jesus is talking about unprofitable servants. And in verse 51, he says, I'm going to cut him in two and appoint his portion with the hypocrites. He gets no reward. The only thing that a hypocrite gets is the approbation of men in this time right now. So Jesus Christ said, if you do your alms to be seen of men, to get glory from men, you've got your reward. That's all you get. So it made me wonder, what is the reward of the faithful Christian? The one who does his alms in secret out of a pure heart of generosity. What is the reward of that man? Well, perhaps that man's reward is the same thing that was that the Pharisees were trying to accrue through their very loudly proclaimed righteous acts. The Pharisees sought the glory that comes from men, but perhaps the reward of the Christian is the true glory that Jesus Christ will bring as his reward to all Christians at his coming. In Hebrews 2 and verse 10, it says, for it became him for whom are all things, and by whom are all things, in bringing many sons unto glory, to make the captain of their salvation perfect through suffering. So one of the purposes of Jesus Christ was to bring many sons to glory. The Pharisees wanted glory. They wanted the glory of men. We all will prefer to have the glory of God. In Isaiah 60, are we going to really truly have the glory of God? We will at the resurrection. In Isaiah 60 and verse 1, it says, "Arise and shine, for your light has come. Arise, rise up out of death, rise up out of the grave. For your light has come, and the glory of the Lord is risen upon you." Not the glory of men. "For behold, darkness shall cover the earth, and gross darkness the people. But the Lord shall arise upon you, and his glory shall be seen upon you." That's the reward of the Christian. The Pharisees wanted to be honored by men. They loved it when they had the honor and the approbation, the fear and the respect of the man on the street. That's not what we're looking for. Here's the honor that each one of us wants. Let's look at John 12 and verse 26. John 12, 26, Jesus says, "If any man serves me, let him follow me. And where I am, there also shall my servant be. And if any man will serve me, him will my Father honor." That's so much better than the honor of the Jew on the street in the first century. The honor of the Father. That's the honor that we are working for. The Pharisees were working to receive the recommendation and the admiration and the congratulations of men. That's not what we're working for. Jesus, when he comes, will give us recognition of an acknowledgement of our accomplishment in the spirit realm. Matthew 25, 21, it's a parable, but this is how Christ rewards the profitable servant. Matthew 25 and verse 21, the Lord of the profitable servant says unto him, "Well done, you good and faithful servant. You have been faithful over a few things. I will make you ruler over many things. Enter you into the joy of your Lord." And the guy that gained profit says, to him he says, "Well done, good and faithful servant. You've been faithful over a few things. I will make you ruler over many things." Who has annual reviews? Let me see your hands. Who has annual reviews? A few of you. Isn't that the most worthless exercise that you have ever participated in? You worked hard all year, and your boss said, "Well, yeah, you did a couple good things, but let's concentrate on all the things you did wrong, right? Here's what I'd like you to do better next year." Jesus Christ is not like that. To the guy that didn't make as big a profit, he said, "Yeah, you made a profit, but if you looked at his example, you'd have earned me twice as much." Well, Jesus Christ doesn't say that. He gives sincere gratitude to us for earning him a profit, whether it's a big profit or a little profit. That's what I'm working for. I want to hear Jesus Christ say, "Well done, you good and faithful servant." That's what I live for. I want to hear that. In this world, you can't hear that. You might get congratulations, but it's always tempered by going over the things you should have done better. Well, Jesus Christ is not like that. He's going to give us sincere congratulations. He's going to acknowledge our accomplishments. So the Pharisees strove for honor and glory and recognition and in the perception in the eyes of men that they were close to God. And whatever they got in the first century, that was it. Perhaps some people regarded them highly. Jesus makes a point of their level of righteousness in Matthew 5 and verse 20. He says, "I say to you, unless Your righteousness exceeds the righteousness of the scribes and the Pharisees. You will in no manner enter the kingdom of heaven. And I bet that knocked the disciples' socks off. They must have thought, well, you're talking about these guys that wear this fine garb out in public and the people who have the right to sit in the best seats in the synagogue. You mean we have to be more righteous than that? What shock do we have at being more righteous than the scribes and the Pharisees? And yet it really wasn't hard at all, was it? Because every good thing that they appeared to be was just pretense. It was phony. They were actors. We may never be highly regarded, respected, recognized by our bosses or our peers for our accomplishments in this age. We must patiently wait for Jesus Christ to bring us that at his return. So, the point in all this is that Jesus Christ said we must have generous hearts. We must be a giving people. And that we must do these good works for their own sake, not for the sake of gaining the respect or the approval or the admiration or the approbation of men. Jesus condemned the men who did this, the Pharisees, for their hypocrisy. All right, one other subject I'll touch on today with respect to being the friends of Christ and executing all his commands. And it's about hypocrisy. So let's turn to Matthew 7, verse 1 to 5. I think this is something where any one of us is more likely to get to the edge of hypocrisy than and the other thing in charitable giving. I think this is a human failing that most of us can fall prey to. Jesus is critical in Matthew 7, verse 1, of those who judge others for faults which they also possess. Matthew 7, verse 1, he says, "Judge not," and the word judge means condemn. "Judge not that you won't be judged, for with whatever judgment you judge, you will be judged. And with the measure you use it, it will be measured back to you. And why do you look at the speck that's in your brother's eye, but don't consider the plank in your own eye? Or how can you say to your brother, 'Let me remove the speck from your eye,' and look, a plank is in your own eye?" And then he labels Christians with the same fault that the Pharisees have. He says, "Hypocrite." Jesus says, if you feel that you are righteous enough to correct or condemn someone who has a fault, you're a hypocrite, he says. You've got the same fault. He said, first remove the plank from your own eye, and then you'll see clearly to remove the speck from your brother's eye. So, again, to judge is to condemn someone as guilty. And we, as humans, we always perceive the faults of others more easily than our own. And Jesus recognizes this as hypocrisy also. If we intend to correct somebody or to judge somebody, we pretend as hypocrites to be more righteous than the person we're condemning. And we should remember, as Jesus said, we'll receive the same kind of judgment. So when we are sure that we have removed the plank, the beam sticking out of our own eyes, can we then go to our brother and address his problem? Well, let me ask, is this kind of like when Peter said to Christ, "How many times shall my brother sin against me and I forgive him?" And he said, 7 times 7? What did Peter say, 7 times 7? Or did he say 7 times? In any case, Christ said, "I don't say 7 times, I tell you 70 times 7. Now, maybe Peter was keeping score with someone. Maybe there was someone who was on the verge of ringing up number 6 sin against him, and he wanted to know how forbearing he had to be. And Jesus said to him, 70 times 7. In other words, you forgive him every time he asks you. So there, to answer Peter's question, There will never be a time when we can stop forgiving someone else. So, when we are sure we have removed the plank from our eye, can we address the brother's problem? When we are sure we have removed the plank from our own eye, when would that be? Would that be like 70 times 7? Maybe never? Maybe never? How do we know the plank's gone from our eye? It's something to think about. So being the friend of Jesus, we must obey his commandment. He's looking for Christians who have a generous spirit. As we have opportunity, let's do good to all, especially, he says, to those who are of the household of faith. Being the friend of Jesus, we must obey his command to be generous, and we have to give wisely to do the most good, but to remember that Jesus is evaluating and judging us, not the frauds and the deadbeats and the drunks and the junkies that we might inadvertently give money to. He's not judging them now. He's judging us. So in being the friend of Jesus, we must obey his command to be generous, and we must do it secretly to keep it between us and him, and we must recognize that Jesus Christ dislikes the hypocrite. The hypocrite is not going to be his friend. So, Jesus was a patient and forgiving man with sinners. You remember the woman who was caught in the act of adultery? He was patient and generous and kind to her. And he sought to minimize, to mitigate her shame and her embarrassment. He didn't rebuke people for sin. One thing I'm not going to talk about today, I think I'll just wrap it up right now. Hardness of heart is something that he had a harder time being gentle with people for. Jesus rebuked people for being hard of heart, and he rebuked people for being hypocrites. Jesus was curt and sharp with hypocrites. So an important part of being the friend of Christ is that we should learn not to disappoint him with attitudes that revolve around hypocrisy.